Well, I have a guilty secret to share. When I was a kid, I used to love reading Hints from Heloise, the syndicated column of household tips that by 1964 was appearing in 593 newspapers. I was always intrigued to see what inventive things Heloise would come up with in response to readers' dilemmas that even I, as a kid that was just helping mom out in the kitchen, would have encountered and was puzzled by. How do you open that jar lid that just won't budge? What do you do with old pantyhose? And there are a lot of things. And how do you clean, you name it, almost anything? Although the original Eloise Bowles Cruz died in 1977, her daughter, a woman with the magnificent name Ponce Kia Marshall Eloise Cruz Evans, has continued in her mother's shoes. And Eloise is still going strong now with books and YouTube videos more prominent in her media presence. For her cleaning tips, I was always struck as I look back by the fact that Eloise would often recommend the simplest, least expensive household staples, like vinegar and baking soda, be used instead of chemical cleaners. She was quite innovative that way. And her early instincts for avoiding chemicals have now been succeeded by a wide variety of online household tips for creating a green household that we can all take advantage of, using three basic principles: reduce, reuse, and recycle. And I think that many of us, regardless of whatever generation we might belong to, began to act on our personal values about environmental protection by making little changes in our household habits. Turning off the water when you brush your teeth rather than letting it run. Paying attention to recyclables and separating them. And making consumer decisions based on environmental values were all small changes that I certainly can remember when I started to consciously act on them and make a change. And it wasn't that hard to do, and it felt good to make these changes. Particularly, I felt good about myself. I was a person of integrity, or at least I was a person who had enough integrity to avoid feeling guilty if I didn't do things that were harder or more expensive to do, such as, I don't know, replacing my toilets with low water models or replacing my electrical supplier with home solar panels or replacing my hybrid car with an electric car. Each of us has a different line that we draw when it comes to acting of our values, regardless of what the social problem is where we could make a difference. And where we draw that line will usually have to do with one or two of a combination of things. How much money will it cost me? How much time will it cost me? How much inconvenience will it subject me to? So our sermon today has come from a question posed by John Botts over a lunch that we had together to discuss his service auction purchase of today's sermon. And John's question was this: can you speak to the gap between valuing environmental protection and sustainability and harmony and becoming an involved environmental activist? And it was John's impression that most people claim to value, and do value, certainly, the preservation and health of the natural environment, but when it comes to action to protect the environment, not only will people's opinions about policies or laws or programs diverge, but there will also be a dramatic drop-off of people who are willing to devote time as activists to seeing whatever policies or laws or programs that they support are actually implemented or sustained. And John also had another issue to raise. He was particularly concerned about the experiences that the new and the next generations, the digital generations, are having within our natural world. In a book that we discussed, The Last Child in the Woods, by Richard Louv, we read, "The shift in our natural world and our relationship to it is startling, even in settings that one would assume are devoted to nature. Not that long ago, summer camp was a place where you camped. You hiked in the woods. You learned about plants and animals, or told firelight stories about ghosts or mountain lions. As likely as not today, summer camp is weight loss camp, or it is computer camp. For a new generation, nature is more abstraction than reality. Increasingly, nature is something to watch, to consume, to wear, to ignore, or maybe to never experience. Reducing that deficit, healing the broken bond between our generations and nature is in our self-interest, not only because aesthetics or justice demand it, but because our mental, physical, and spiritual health depends on it. The health of the earth, of course, is at stake as well. How the young respond to nature, how they will be raising their own children, will shape the configurations and conditions of our cities and our homes and our daily lives." So having thought about this for a while now, John and I had our lunch together 2 months ago, in January, right? I was interested in our Earth Day service a couple of weeks ago, led by members of our youth group. And in light of this conversation that we'd been having, I was all ears to see what I could learn from them about how they see and would talk about the environmental crisis that we face. And as I listened to the inspiring reflections offered by Molly Schur, is that how you pronounce Molly's last name? Sure, yeah. And Andrew McKay and Paisley Ashland, I interpreted them as being based on three different theological insights into the spiritual challenge of being an environmental activist. I heard Molly's reflections on being embodied as a call to avoid abstraction and to take seriously and personally the ways that doing harm to the earth is doing harm to a real body of which we are a part. It is violence in the way that I was speaking about it earlier when we had our ritual. And then Andrew referenced the Shinto faith of Japan, which reminds us in their spirituality that each aspect of this world is filled with a living spirit that can be honored and recognized, and we can experience personally as we experience another human person. I found both Molly and Andrew's reflections to be in sharp contrast with the dominant theology of our Western culture that most of us who are older have grown up with, the theology influenced by that passage in Genesis that we read this morning that gives humankind the right to have mastery over the earth and all its creatures. So when you believe you are among the masters, you have the right to dominate someone or something, it makes it easier to exploit it. And I think what Molly and Andrew were pointing to was more reflective of an emerging new theology of environmental responsibility that has emerged in our lifetimes that's based on three foundational spiritual commitments. Commitments to non-dual thinking, to intersectionality, and to seeking out communities of resilience. Now, our reading today that Denise offered was from a new volume of essays that you can get from our UU bookstore in Boston called Justice on Earth, and it's a collection of essays written by mostly younger Unitarian Universalist ministers exploring these commitments. Reverend Jennifer Nordstrom invited us to think of the environment as something that is not separate from us, not something out there to which I pay a visit when I go out my door, but instead to expand our understanding of the environment as everything that constitutes our world inside and outside. And as she said, non-human nature, the streets, people, patterns of oppression, different experiences of the environment mitigated by those patterns of oppression, as well as the trees and the water and the earth. This is what I mean by a non-dualistic way of seeing the world in which we live. And it is also an intersectional worldview. Nordstrom continues, contrary to some understandings of environmentalism, including many Unitarian Universalist framings, the environment is not simply a natural wilderness that is in need of saving. Indeed, we can see that that kind of understanding has some grounding in our history of colonialism and white supremacy. Instead, there is not a single experience of the environment that human beings have that is divorced from other relationships or any unified experience of humanity that is divorced from the environment in which we live. So this is a concept, this intersectionality, that is inclusive of the seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism, that we affirm the interdependent web of existence of which we're all a part. And yet I believe it goes beyond that. There isn't an interdependent web that is apart from us. We are, in fact, the web. We are co-creators of the web. The interdependent web includes not just the beauty of the natural world. The interdependent web includes social systems that involve power and how it's exercised, and oppression. Influenced by the old theology and at our human worst, nature has become something that we exploit for our own satisfaction. And at our best, nature is something we appreciate because it serves a purpose for us. It helps us connect with our spiritual lives. But in a non-dual intersectional theology, we have to go beyond our love of nature to express our love of this whole complicated, messed up, people-polluted environment understood in this bigger way and act on that love. So here's one concrete example. Cape Town, South Africa. I don't know if any of you have been there. I haven't yet. My daughter has. It's got to be one of the most beautiful natural locations for a city on this planet. And it is a mess. In recent months, most of us have been hearing on the news that this city of almost 2.5 million people has been creeping slowly towards day zero, which is the day that all of the water taps in the city are going to be turned off and people will have to line up for water at 200 centralized distribution sites. Now, the date is shifting because water conservation measures implemented over the last year and a half have been pushing it back, and that's good. But there is really no end right now in sight to the three-year drought that has decimated the reservoirs. And Cape Town will likely arrive at day zero sooner or later. And this is not unlike some other places that have experienced similar water crises, São Paulo, Brazil. Even Southern California have had similar crises, while the normal cycle of drought and rainfall have seemed to stretch out longer and have worse consequences because there are more people and needs for the water. But Cape Town is a really powerful case study of how environmental crises are connected to more than just natural cycles or the consequences of climate change. Water distribution has always been a problem in Cape Town, and many people have had to get their ration of water from a central distribution line for many, many years. And we didn't call that an environmental crisis then. It had another name. We called it apartheid. Day zero is not the first day when people will have to line up for water, but it may be the first day that most white people and tourists have to line up for water. Because South Africa has such a stark history of overt racial discrimination, it is easy to see that despite now two decades of majority rule under black governments, that the embedded patterns of privilege and class that were originally strongly associated with race have not changed. Now, Cape Town's government might have foreseen this water crisis. And in fact, efforts were made. Preemptive proposals for water rationing were put forth early on that were not acceptable across the board, especially to wealthier people or to the important and lucrative tourist industry. And there were delays in developing designs that could be implemented in the best locations for locating water, saltwater desalination plants, because the best locations were actually too close to the most desirable upscale neighborhoods that were located, of course, near the water. Cape Town's dilemma illustrates this new intersectional understanding of our environmental crisis. But on the other side of the scale, Cape Town is also a poster child city right now for a new Rockefeller Foundation initiative to create what they are calling resilient cities by offering them access to tools, funding, technical expertise, and other resources to create more resilience in cities that are threatened by these challenges of the 21st century that involve not only climate change, but globalization and urbanization of traditional societies. So Cape Town could be a place where a multicultural community that nevertheless continues to live with vast income inequality differences might find creative common ground about new ways to distribute and share resources that belong to everybody. We hope so. But there will not be a quick fix to these challenges. And that's why resilient communities and individuals have to take the long view. And in her reflections on Earth Day, Paisley Ashland offered encouragement for environmental activists looking for spiritual sustenance for the long haul. She used the metaphor of the endless task of Sisyphus, who is trying to push a boulder up a steep slope only to have it routinely roll back to the bottom because of its own weight. And Paisley reminded us, though, that when we think about this mountain of environmental challenges we face, that the actual act of pushing the boulder up the mountain and it rolling down is in a small way wearing that mountain down. And even though on any given issue it may seem we never quite get values that we espouse up over the top, even the pushing the boulder uphill still wears the mountain down over time. It's worth remembering when the small changes that we know we can make do seem inconsequential compared to the magnitude of the challenges. But the fact is, we got into the situation we're in now because of billions of decisions made by individuals to desire, to accept, and to pay for conveniences and luxuries that prioritize our comforts over the long-term health of the planet. And we can only start getting out of this by making different decisions in the arenas where we have power. Now, those arenas start with our own household, but include the neighborhood and the town and the various levels of government at which our voices do make a difference. So I have a short list of household tips for how to save the planet. No surprises really in them. There are just two, and the second one I'm going to expand on to conclude. So my first tip at the top of the list is don't hesitate to make whatever small changes that you can. All those small things involving reducing and reusing and recycling in anyone's household that we can do or that we can expand with a little bit of sacrifice or effort are all small changes that do help wear down that mountain. And bigger changes are often easier to make because we were willing to make the small changes and they didn't turn out to be that bad. To be motivated to move beyond your personal household into donating, to personally supporting, or to volunteering for environmental activism, however, I think you need a different kind of household tip, one that changes you from the inside. So my second household tip is based on something I've been saying already in the sermon. It's a broad brush tip. Try to see the inside and the outside as one thing. And I want to break that down into more specific spiritual lessons. As how we think about what constitutes our household changes, as we start to live in what the poet Gary Snyder called earth household, instead of the four walls of our own preoccupations, we should have no illusions about what that change actually involves for us. It means that we have to become willing to feel the pain of the earth and not push it away. The eco-theologian Joanna Macy, who used to teach at our seminary in Berkeley, Star King School, taught a generation of our ministers that they could close the gap between giving lip service to eco-justice and being resilient long-term activists by some fundamental insights as guidance, as touchstones. And I'd like to end with these. They are what I call the deep six steps that you need to take if you can follow my second household tip. First, as we've said, this world in which we are born and have our being is a living body. It is not a thing. And our true nature is connected to that living body and is far more ancient and encompassing than the separate self that is defined by our habits and by our society. And then third, our pain for the world springs from how interconnected we feel with all beings. And it is that pain from which our power to act on their behalf arises. Unblocking our commitment to activism occurs when our pain for the world is not only intellectually validated, but experienced, where it actually really hurts. We reconnect with life as a whole by being willing to endure our pain for it. And in that experience of the pain of the world, our mind retrieves its natural clarity. And that kind of reconnection with the Earth community is more powerful in arousing our desire to act on its behalf. The people I know and the people I have read who have been most successful at being resilient and effective eco-activists are not those who make time to enjoy a beautiful sunset. They're the people that feel the pain of the earth regularly and have felt that the only healing for that pain can emerge from their own activism. May we each find that resilience in our own ways, and may we draw on this faith tradition that claims the radical interconnectedness of all existence, that recognizes intersecting forms of oppression and violence and destruction, that celebrates the divine as imminent and in our lives, and that enjoys the abundant resources of beauty and love and care all around us, and especially in this community that can sustain our efforts. May it be so.